I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, so you'll just have to look at me. Before we get going, though, I should probably note that I actually met my fiance, Jill Fehrenbacher, right over there about 8 years ago. Sorry it took so long. But she made me promise that I would mention her design blog in Habitat, otherwise the engagement's off. So you should check it out right after you read Engadget. Anyway, I don't know how many people here are familiar with Engadget. It's basically a blog about gadgets, consumer electronics, personal technology, and I'm someone who's really obsessed with technology, gadgets, about having the latest thing, about starting to see where things are going. And one of the things that, when I started Engadget and then Gizmodo before that, that I really tried to emphasize in my writing and that I thought was lacking from a lot of the writing about technology was the importance of design and the importance of how, as you're creating something, it really needs to satisfy all these different levels of not just the consumer experience, but also how that device fits into the other devices in a consumer's life. So for what I'm going to talk about is really about how do you create successful technology today. And we're in a really radically different situation than we were really just 5 years ago, but you can really see the difference between today and 10, 15 years ago. And gadgets, as sort of apropos for this present, for today, gadgets are really part of ecosystems today. They're really not just standalone devices anymore. You look back like 20, 30 years ago, a television was just a television, right? And it was really only over, it took decades before a television was something that you hooked up to your, you know, cable, or you hooked up to a satellite, or you hooked up to a VCR and became part of a larger ecosystem. So what I'm going to do is talk about a couple things, and I know we're running really late, so I'll try to keep it as short as possible so we can get onto the discussion. But I'm going to talk about sort of what goes into designing a gadget today, and then sort of move on from there and talk about platforms and open versus closed platforms and how that really influences the ecosystems of gadgets and technology today. So how many people here own iPods? It's going to be a lot, I bet. You guys are so predictable. Okay, I don't own an iPod. And I can talk about that later on maybe, but there are a lot of reasons for it. But I'm going to talk about sort of not really why the iPod was successful, because I think you've probably heard that talk a lot of times. What I want to talk about is really what goes into making an MP3 player. And it's not just like it was when the first MP3 players were introduced in the late 90s. It was really just about creating a piece of hardware, right? And you didn't have the software applications on the PC. You didn't have this sort of integrated experience that you have today. And basically what you had was consumers were left to fend for themselves. If they wanted to have MP3s to put onto their device, they had to rip those from their CDs and encode them themselves and get it onto the device by, they had to figure out their own way to connect the player to their PC. It's usually over a very slow connection. It wasn't like today where you have FireWire and USB where it takes just a few seconds to transfer over albums. But what we've seen is that as it's evolved, it's about hardware. You have to have software that actually runs on the player itself. And a lot of people don't really think about this aspect of it, but it's one of the reasons why the iPod is so successful is that they created a good user experience. But even beyond that, you actually have to have software that runs on the PC that you're tethering the device to, because an iPod or any kind of MP3 player on its own is useless. You have to tether it to another device to get music onto it in the first place, right? But then even beyond that, what we've seen in the past few years is that now it's not just about this ecosystem of the iPod or other MP3 player and your laptop or your PC. It's also about this entire infrastructure about delivering music. And so let's say that you, the Apple is actually not necessarily the best example of this, because they kind of control all the parts of the ecosystem. And I'll talk about that in the open versus closed section in a little while, in a few moments. But you take a company like Rhapsody, right? They offer a music download service that's a rival to the iTunes Music Store. So they have to put together all these pieces of a puzzle to create a consumer experience. They have to basically get the labels to agree to license their music. They have to create a delivery infrastructure, which is a front-end application that's connected to the internet that then connects to a back-end infrastructure for delivering music. And then they actually have to have a whole system of digital rights management for protecting the music that they're selling. And in the case of Rhapsody, we're talking about putting together all sorts of different players. It's not Rhapsody that develops the entire system. So unlike Apple, they don't sell the player. So you have to buy a player from someone like Creative or SanDisk or iRiver, and it connects up with the Rhapsody client that they offer. But Rhapsody doesn't actually even necessarily build the infrastructure themselves. They actually license a lot of that technology from another company. But then they actually, on top of that, license their digital rights management system from Microsoft. And all of these parts sort of have to work together in a device ecosystem. And right now, the result is that it doesn't work very well, and which is one of the reasons why Apple has been so successful in sort of positioning, establishing the iPod as the dominant digital audio player in not just in the US, but more or less globally. They're able to sort of control this end-to-end experience. They sell the player, they sell the software on the player, they create the software that runs on your computer. And in many cases, if you own a Mac, they actually create the computer that you're using to tether to the device as well. And you know, people sort of forget about this, but it was actually a really big deal when Apple decided to support basically iTunes on the PC. And they even announced it as Hell Has Frozen Over. It was sort of a big sea change, and they're thinking about how much of this ecosystem do they need to control. And this sort of idea of open versus closeness is something that sort of reverberates around the technology industry today. I'm going to talk about one more example of this and sort of looking at cell phones. And everyone here has a cell phone. I'd be surprised if anyone here didn't, though someone does raise your hand. I'm blown away. I'm impressed. Okay. So what do you do? Excellent. I don't know what we did before I had one. Yeah, exactly. No, I actually was when on the airport flying here, I noticed that all the payphones had been removed from a bank of phones. And I was trying to figure out what you would do with that, you know, why they didn't just remove the entire sort of infrastructure. It's just sort of like a ghost town for payphones. So cell phones today, it's sort of like a similar thing, but it's even more complicated and convoluted. So you have all these different players that go, that participate in basically delivering this wireless experience to the consumer. You know, you have companies that create the cell phones, right, the manufacturers, and, you know, Nokia, Motorola, Sony Ericsson, and they sell these phones to their real customers, which are the wireless carriers. And then the wireless carriers subsidize these devices and then sell them on to consumers to convince them to sign up for wireless service. But even beyond that, we have now, as cell phones get smarter and become more capable, what we're finding is that it's not just about making phone calls, right? It's about becoming a multifunction device. And so all of a sudden, the operating system that runs on the cell phone is now important as well. And so now you have another player introduced into this ecosystem. So for instance, if you are you know, Sony Ericsson or Nokia, you license a operating system called Symbian, right? And you run that on your cell phones. And so that's another player that factors into all of this. But then there are other parts of the equation that don't get talked about very much. For instance, the companies that actually sell the chipsets, the wireless chipsets that get put into the devices. And so companies like Qualcomm that you know, create a lot of the chips that run, that basically allow our phones to connect to the internet, to the wireless internet, or to make phone calls. And these companies also wield a tremendous amount of power over the manufacturers. And so they can, you know, depending on which manufacturers they favor, they can control the number of devices that a manufacturer is able to sell, or even control the pace of product development. And so it's not just saying, I'm going to make a cell phone. You actually have to line up all these different elements. You have to line up, you know, the company that makes the wireless chipset. You have to you'd have to work with the company that develops the user interface or operating system for your device. And so one of the things that my readers complain about a lot is, why is it taking so long to get really nice cell phones here in the US? And one of the reasons is that because the process of actually developing devices is so complicated and so convoluted, and there's so many players involved, that it's not just it's not really just about creating something and selling it. You have to get all these different, you know, partners on board. And of course, once you actually have the phone made and manufactured and ready to go, then it gets delivered to the wireless carriers, who will sometimes spend up to a year testing the phone in the wild before they'll agree to sell it. And what the end result of this is that the manufacturers find that their products are coming out much more slowly than they should. The consumer is getting frustrated. They see technologies that are available but aren't ready for purchase yet. And it caused a lot of sort of disconnect between what consumers want and what is actually available to them. And it actually is one of the reasons why when you look at sort of the consumers and the consumer experience when it relates to technology, is that there's a lot of frustration today. And I think people sort of keep getting sold this promise of, you know, ubiquitous wireless internet, or the, you know, being able to easily download movies to from the you know, movies from the internet, or being able to do what you want with your media. And that promise hasn't been fulfilled yet, and it may actually never be fulfilled. Despite all the talk of convergence, there are some pretty interesting trends going on right now that are really hindering this sort of convergence nirvana, which we've been promised for decades now. And what I'm going to talk about and is this idea of sort of open versus closed. And one of the biggest sort of trends we've seen is that as big companies like Sony and Apple, Microsoft, as they are sort of moving into this digital age and this age of entertainment being delivered over the internet, they each big company wants to control that experience. They want to own that relationship with the consumer. And so they're each creating their own balkanized ecosystems that don't necessarily interact with each other. And that's why, you know, the anecdote about Sony and its own devices not being interoperable with each other. But it's even, the problem is that Sony's devices didn't also speak with Samsung's devices, which didn't speak with Toshiba's devices. And so what's happening is that, you know, this idea that you're going to have in your home one box, and it's going to have a giant hard drive, and it's going to have a fiber optic connection to the internet. It's going to pull down all your media, whether it's music or movies or television or whatever. And then from there, you're going to have sort of a little network within the home of satellite devices, so you can, you know, pull your music that's on your hard drive and listen to it in any room in the house. What's happening is that that dream is sort of it's sort of as William Gibson said, it's sort of not evenly distributed yet. The future is here for some people, but the process of actually enjoying this convergence experience is it's a little difficult for most consumers to enjoy it, because all these big companies are so obsessed with controlling the experience that they aren't making their devices interoperable with each other. What we're seeing now are companies like Intel trying to create platforms, right? How many here people have heard of Vive, which they introduced at the Consumer Electronics Show? You're going to be hearing a lot more about it, I promise. No one really knows what Vive is. And I write about technology for a living, and I don't really understand it. I've asked Intel to tell me what it is, and I just get marketing speak from there. But generally, from what I understand, Vive is basically a platform of digital rights management that enables people to move content safely around an ecosystem, whether it's your home or work or wherever you're enjoying media. Now, what's going on, though, is that Intel is trying to create and control this ecosystem. They want all these devices to run on Intel chips, right? They sell processors, and that's what they want. And so if you want to participate in this Vive ecosystem, your devices, whether it's a, you know, a DVD player with a hard drive or a PC or a TiVo, they all have to have this special Vive technology to connect into that ecosystem. Now, Intel's major rival, AMD, they've come out with their own version of this that rivals what Intel is doing. And we see this over and over and over again, where each company sort of wants to own this process and own this relationship with the consumer. And the net result has been that convergence as a category, convergence as a business, has actually seen very, very limited growth. Because instead of realizing that the biggest obstacle when it comes to creating and selling and marketing these products is really getting consumers to change their behavior and adopt them in the first place. So if you think about with the MP3 player, it was really the first, just getting someone to buy an MP3 player, any kind of MP3 player in the first place, that's a challenge, because you have to change the way someone thinks about their media, about their music. And we're trying, you know, these companies, you're trying to do the same thing when it comes to convergence and about creating a new ecosystem of products. And the more open and interoperable a platform that you can participate in, the more likely that, yes, you're not going to own convergence, but you're going to own a significant portion of convergence. And you know, when it comes to developing products, and I'm not sure how many people here actually develop, you know, consumer electronics or design or engineering, stuff like that, but when it comes to designing these things, there has to be an emphasis on openness. And I know that Apple has sort of been unusually successful with its very closed ecosystem. But in the long run, generally speaking, openness is both best for consumers and best for business. Thanks.